We're back with KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Dr. Mary Frances Berry, a highly regarded author and civil rights activist, was this year's keynote speaker for the annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. Berry's activism in the early 80s was spent fighting against the apartheid in South Africa. She was even arrested a few times for her efforts. But her call to activism started with another civil rights icon, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And that's where our conversation begins. Since we're celebrating the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we have to talk about what he represented, which was change through an approach of nonviolence during the civil rights movement. And even now, his legacy continues to transcend across multiple generations. Why do you think that is?
Well, the tactic of using nonviolence worked because it has moral authority in that it does not seek to punish anybody in particular. There's no violence involved or assault. And it also comes from a spiritual base. Martin Luther King was a spiritual man. He was a preacher and he was a spiritual man, in addition to being what I call a race man, a poverty man, a believer in justice of all kinds. So that there's a moral authority about being willing to put yourself at risk. This has been done in other countries. He and Coretta mainly got these ideas from the philosophy of people like Gandhi and others. The idea is that you put yourself at risk, you put yourself on the line, and when you are attacked or undermined, you simply take it and move on. And you make sure that the issues that you're talking about are about fairness and justice and have a basis. And the moral authority of it, in a sense, makes the persons or the institutions that you are resisting or where you're trying to get a change, eventually the change comes. Some change comes. It's reform by example, by pressure, and by willing to bear risk.
Well, this leads me to the next question. How has Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. been influential in your life?
The assassination of Martin Luther King, the day that happened, I now recall in retrospect, is the day that I became ever more committed to working on issues of justice. And over the years, I spent time talking with Coretta from that day until the day she passed away, until she got sick. Talking about these issues and every cause that where injustice has been perceived or experienced, I've tried to do what I could to ameliorate the problem. And so he was an enormous and remains an enormous influence in my own life. The fact that he was cut down so young, too, when there he is. We will never know what he would look like if he were an old man. Because I was thinking about that when Mandela got out of prison and we were able to see what he looked like after all those years of having a picture of him when he was young, that we'd never see that with Martin Luther King. He was martyred in the cause, and he was not a perfect man, but he was a committed man and he was willing to sacrifice.
Now, with that being said, in 2009, President Barack Obama became the surrogate of that change. He became the first president of color, and many believed that he would, you know, as a result of him becoming our president, racism would in America would phase out. But obviously, that's not the case. From your own research and experience throughout the years, can you kind of explain why it hasn't gone that way?
Well, first of all, there are some historians who believe he was not our first president of color, that there were other presidents who had some racial background, which we do not acknowledge or mention, but I won't get into that. Let's assume he was. Mm-hmm. The reason why he didn't end racism is because his election was not about ending racism. In fact, his election, I spent a lot of time commenting on the election in 2008 on the television almost every night during the race. And it was clear that some people were voting for him because they wanted a black president, and some people were voting for him because their children wanted a black president, and some people were voting for him not because they thought he was going to change the country and racism would end, but that it was a symbol of how far we'd come, and then we could brag about, you know, how far we'd come as a country. Not that anyone in particular meant to do anything. And I think Martin Luther King would be the first person to say that symbolism is important, and his election, Barack Obama's election, was important. But the most important thing is what you do about the social problems that exist to create justice. And many of the people who had resisted him, Obama, and some people who voted for him, who then went away and thought that, oh, well, now we voted for him, everything's fine, or we can tell everybody everything's fine. And there was continued resistance from day one by people in the Congress and elsewhere who said that they didn't plan to do anything except figure out a way to get rid of him in the end. So his election was important symbolically. But all that talk about how we were going to be post-racial, I never engaged in that kind of discussion, didn't believe it. And electing him, he was elected in part because, though he is a black man, chooses to be a black man, that he, in fact, has all of the credentials that anyone would expect, and better than most people who have been president of the United States. So no one can say he isn't qualified to be president of the United States. And so, therefore, he could, as Joe Biden, who was the vice president, of course, said during the campaign that Obama was clean and articulate. And he's more than that. And so I never expected racism to go away. In fact, I expected it to increase, and it probably did if the polls are right. But we never know if they're right because they weren't right about the election.
Well, is it possible for us to enter into a place where racism is on the decline, where it's something that we have learned from and we are actively trying to change rather than just talking about it?
Well, every time some episode occurs that is particularly horrendous around race, all of the media and many of the pundits start talking about how we need a national conversation on race. And I don't think we need a conversation. What we need is reconciliation. In South Africa, not everything is perfect, and there are severe economic problems there since the end of apartheid because of the deal that was made to get rid of it. But in any case, they had a reconciliation commission, and other countries have done that, in which people who had done evil things got up and confessed in public to what they had done and how they were sorry. And people talked to each other, and people then forgave them, and in some cases. We probably need a reconciliation kind of conversation, and not a conversation about race as such. Usually when we have a conversation about race, the only people who engage in it are people who are already trying not to be anti-racist.
Well, going back to the theme of your address, it's now is the time, what will you do? And as we mentioned, President Barack Obama is going to be wrapping up his 8 years in office on Friday, the same day as President-elect Donald Trump, who will be sworn in.
Yes.
And we've talked about this a little bit here. During his presidency, issues of revolving race relations in America have worsened. And with the entrance of President-elect Donald Trump, some might say it's reached new heights, especially if we include the concepts of gender inequality and the LGBT community into this particular conversation. With this in mind, what should people do in the face of our current political and societal climates?
Well, people who are not supportive of the change that has took place in the election and the direction that the country seems to be in need to organize, and they need to fight. There's a women's march on Saturday in Washington and around the country in various places. There are people need to organize along with people in their local communities to resist. They need. We have resisted before. It's not. We've been here before when we had bad things happen. And so there are all kinds of social movements in which we've resisted in this country. The civil rights movement is not the only time. Everything from, you can name, you know, women's suffrage, the anti-war movement, you know, there have been, there are all kinds of movements that have taken place, and change has been made as a result of those. So people need to organize to resist. They need to do something. They need to do what my mother used to call getting up off your do-nothing stool. That's the way she put it. Get up off your do-nothing stool. Go do something. Join with people locally. Do something. Run for office. I mean, go, if there's a dog catcher opening, and run for dog catcher. If there's a school board election, run for it. You know, run as if your life depended on it. And make clear in terms of protest. And protests consist, nonviolent protests, not just marching, but also calling or sending emails or texts or using social media, inundating congressional offices with how you feel about whatever's going on, and to do it consistently and persistently. Do whatever you have time to do to while you go on with your life and keeping your body and soul together. But people have to organize to resist, and that's what they have to, and they also have to do what John Lewis is doing, which is to make clear that you don't accept the present reality as reality forever. See? And that's what movement's about. This may be what is, you know, practical, or maybe what is pragmatic and real, but we want change. It was too many of us thought that change was, positive change was promised to us because we had so much of it in the last 15 or 20 years in the domestic arena. And sometimes it seemed easy in retrospect, but I'm talking about LGBTQ issues like same-sex marriage and so on. But there's no straight line. I mean, people. Some people are still in shock. You know, they can't believe that the move forward that they were counting on isn't going to continue. Well, you got to get over that.
Well, when we're talking about protest, we have seen a variety of different forms of protesting throughout the last year and previous years. But the two that are that have been standing out as of late would be the Black Lives Matter movement, combating issues of police brutality and systemic issues of oppression. And then you have, on the other side of that, the alt-right movement. And one thing that I want to know is, what do these movements say about our current state of the country? Because they're very different.
Well, what they say is that the country is very polarized. It has been polarized for a long time, and it's getting worse. And the reason why it has been polarized, and there's been so much talk about this in the media, but it's polarized because we have no consensus about what it means to be an American. We have stopped teaching civics in the schools and history in a lot of places. We teach things. We don't actually have history courses in, you know, students used to take history in elementary school and all through K through 12. And when they do take history, now there are big fights over textbooks, so you leave some stuff out, you know. So we don't have any real consensus. It's like we've lost our moorings on some sides of the issues. But people are polarized. They take their position. The media is part of it. People read what they want to read and listen to what they want to listen to and pretend like the other things don't exist. You know, if you like Fox, you listen to Fox. If you like CNN or you like MSNBC or whatever it is you like, you don't want anybody to tell you anything about whatever's on any other show. I watch all the channels. I want to see what everybody's saying. You don't read the Wall Street Journal. You read the New York Times, or you don't read anything, but you've got your mind made up, you see. And so there's too much of that going on in the society. And when, so therefore, when people divide up that way, you get political movements like that. And then you get movements like Black Lives Matter, which is responding to horrific attacks and killing of people without arms. And I've always, I think that there should be merit raises given to police officers who solve crimes without killing unarmed people. I mean, I think that would be great. You know, have ceremonies where they get a lot of money and because they solved the thing and they didn't kill anybody who was unarmed, rather than praising people and acquitting them in court cases when actually they kill people who are unarmed. And now we're at a, and Black Lives Matter is one of the best things, in my opinion, that has happened. It's wonderful that those three women got together and have able. But they are at risk now because with the new, the change that has taken place, there's going to be greater surveillance and greater attacks on people who take those positions. So the alt-right is in ascendancy, and groups that are on the side of the continued progress on the kind of equality and justice that we've been talking about are now in decline or at risk. And we all have to organize to try to help and protect them.
So are we possibly, this current generation, could we possibly see another civil rights movement like we saw in the 60s, where there was at points outright violence happening in the streets?
Violence against protesters,
yes.
Violence against people who insist on having their rights protected and who insist on saying that the law should be enforced. We have a guy who's going to be Attorney General of the United States. This has happened before. We had an Attorney General when Reagan was president who didn't enforce the law. We had one when Nixon was president who announced he wasn't going to enforce the law when it came to civil rights. So this is not new. But now what's making it worse is people who are thinking that, oh, well, we won the election, and now we have the media, of course, and social media and better communications and all that, which makes it easier to organize and also makes it easier to follow people and keep them under surveillance. So it's got, you know, it's a two-edged sword. But, yes, we could see conflict. It depends on the leadership. A lot of it's going to depend on what Trump does as president, whether he finally tries to make peace with people who didn't vote for him and tries to spread oil on the troubled waters, or whether he continues to be in contention and continues to, every time anybody says anything, you know, he has to take umbrage, and that encourages his supporters to do the same thing.
Well, it brings up this question of when you have all of these issues that are happening within our society, and during his campaign, you had people like David Duke, who was a former leader of the Klan, KKK. How do you go about bringing people together when your platform was the opposite of what the current administration was?
Well, in a campaign, campaigning is about winning. So in a campaign, candidates tell lies in campaigns. That's not unusual. Campaigns appeal to, sometimes they appeal to people you think they shouldn't be appealing to. They say all kinds of things. And then you think, well, when the campaign is over, that'll be the end of that. But the problem here is, until now, during the transition, it's not clear that the campaign is over. So what I'm saying is that there ought to be, you know, when Thomas Jefferson won the presidency after a very hard fight with the Federalists, and people issued broadsides and did all kinds of things to undermine each other, which we would call dirty tricks. There have always been dirty tricks in campaigns. and lies and everything else. When he gave his inaugural address and in the way he behaved after that, he said, we are all Republicans, you know, we're all Federalists, we're all Americans, and let's, you know, stop the bitterness and the dirty tricks, and at least insofar as we know, he stopped doing all that stuff. Some presidents haven't, like Richard Nixon and his dirty tricks, and so we had all this polarization. He ended up, of course, getting having to resign. But with Trump, you don't know where the campaigning stops, and we don't know that yet. I can only hope that it will stop.
That's our show. A special thanks to my guests, Dr. Julie Ray and Dr. Mary Frances Berry. You can find these stories on our website at krcu.org or find us on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join us next week for another edition of KRCU's Going Public.